Hello, I'm John Wilson. Thanks for downloading Master Tapes from BBC Radio 4. Woo! Welcome to Master Tapes, to Mike Scott and Steve Wickham of the Waterboys, playing live here at the BBC Maida Vale Studios. They've come to talk and play their way back to the making of Fisherman's Blues, the 1988 album that included songs such as When You Go Away, We Will Not Be Lovers, and the title track, which set the tone for the whole record. Love, ceiling bearing down on me. Mike Scott and Steve Wickham of the Waterboys, welcome to Master Tapes. Now, Mike, Fisherman's Blues marked such a personal and musical departure for you as a songwriter and leader of the band. You'd released three previous albums, the most recent being This Is the Sea, which was a kind of epic-sounding rock record. And Fisherman's Blues is very, very different. It's folky, it's spontaneous, it's very free-spirited. And that's all about your move to Dublin in, when was that, 1986?
January 86, yeah.
And what took you there in the first place?
Well, Steve had joined the band a few months previously, and he lived in Dublin. And we'd come off the road, and he said, why don't you come and stay for a few weeks, man? So I went and camped out on Steve's floor for a few weeks, and I liked the place so much, I ended up staying for 6 years, not on his floor.
No. At the time, you were really on the verge of full-blown stardom, weren't you? Were you turning your back on that consciously, or was it just the music that led you into these new directions?
We were tipped, if you know what I mean.
People
were expecting us to go in a particular stratospheric direction. But when we made This Is the Sea, I brought that music as far as I could, that layered, widescreen, cinematic rock sound. I love it and loved it then. But I couldn't take it anywhere else. I'd realised it. And I'd begun to get frustrated with not being able to reproduce it on stage. And I envied simpler forms of music like country music and gospel and blues and folk because they were the same in the studio and on stage. And I wanted to play something that would be the same whether we were playing informally or in front of an audience. I wanted that degree of organic normalness, if you know what I mean.
And people had described the music that you'd making up until that point as the big music.
So they say, yes.
On the album Pagan Place, there's a song called The Big Music.
Yeah.
And were you happy with that, or did that constrain you? Did that mean that there was an expectation of the sort of thing that you would deliver every time?
No, I wasn't really bothered about that. I was bothered maybe that the record company wanted us to keep repeating it.
Right.
And when we did our first sessions for Fisherman's Blues, it was during my first few weeks staying with Steve on his floor in Dublin. And we'd been singing these songs at parties and in pubs, these country and western songs, and I wanted to get them down on tape. But I didn't want to come under any pressure, so I didn't tell the record company I'd even booked a studio. I kind of did it on the QT, and we went in and we spent a day recording all these strange acoustic fiddly mandolin songs, but in a pure way. And if I told the record company, they would have said, ah, come on, only do a few of those. Oh, but more This Is the Sea kind of music. And I didn't want to get caught with that.
And Steve Wickham, you were playing in a variety of bands. You're playing in the pubs and clubs of Dublin. What did you know of Mike's?
I wasn't playing in the pubs and clubs in Dublin.
Were you not?
No, I was in a band called Intuanua.
Yeah.
Kind of an Irish Celtic band. We were signed to Island Records. But I play fiddle, so I find myself in lots of sessions.
When did you first come across Mike? What was the first you knew of him? What was his reputation before you start working?
Well, actually, the very first time I discovered Mike was my Irish band in Intuanua got signed to Island Records, and they gave us a big pile of records to bring back to Ireland. I got Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, which I remember, and one of the guys got a Waterboys record. He was mad about it. He said, you've got to hear this, you've got to hear this. And I heard it, and it kind of went by me like a breeze, and I didn't notice it, really, I have to say.
You've never told me that.
I did. I loved it, but I was kind of, it just went by me. I didn't catch me.
Oh. Awkward.
Thin ice now, man.
Oh, man. That was the first. And then Mike,
right.
I got a call from Mike in the early hours of the afternoon one day. And he said, will you come over and play on a record? And I put one and one together. Oh, that's your man from the Water Pies. Oh,
he'd gone by me in a breeze.
No, the music. You know the way a book, the greatest books of all time, you can pick them up and they don't hit you. It just went by me. Missed me. I was kind of looking at something else.
You're doing
the time.
Well. Yeah. Good. You're getting out of it well.
But in fact, we're talking about Fisherman's Blues as if that is the first meeting point. But Steve, you'd played on the previous album, On This Is the Sea, you'd played on the track The Pan Within. That was the first meeting, Mike, wasn't it, on that solo on that
I'd
record.
Heard Steve on a demo for this young singer called Sinead O'Connor, who no one had ever heard of. And Sinead's demo was good. She was a good singer. But what really caught my ear was the fiddler behind her. And I thought, this guy's got the sound that I've been waiting for. So I tracked him down and phoned him up and asked him to come and play in a session. We had one song still to finish on This Is the Sea. That was called The Pan Within.
How would that have worked? You've got the idea for The Pan Within. Maybe you can explain.
Well, the song was already recorded. Every element was in place. And he put this sort of web of fabulous fiddle hooks on. Do you want to play a couple of them? Well, let's go into the second verse. Close your eyes, breathe slow, and we'll begin. Close your eyes, breathe slow.
Been an excerpt from The Pan Within, but it was string-breakingly good. You've lost one off your 12-string there, Mike.
I've still got 11, man.
You've still got 11 strings. Fanboy interjection. I saw you play that song at the Glastonbury Festival in 1986. I think, Steve, you were there on stage with the Waterboys that night. And if I remember rightly, Mike, you started off with Because the Night, Patti Smith, and you segued seamlessly into The Pan Within and then came back to Because the Night at the end.
Yeah, it was kind of medley we used to do, yeah. We used to improvise all the time, John, both in the studio and on stage. I love that. I love having songs that are open-ended and could go anywhere. And with players of the calibre of Steve and Anto, our great sax and mandolin player, and Trevor, our bass player, who was a master improviser, it was possible for me to take the music with whatever idea struck me in the moment. If I wanted to tell a story over the music or go into some weird instrumental, I could do it. The guys could follow me.
You recently published an autobiography, Adventures of a Waterboy, and you talk there about being a kid in Edinburgh and being on a bus and hearing music in your head and drumming out a rhythm on the floor of the top deck of the bus and the bus driver stopping and telling you to stop it. But you heard music formed.
He used more colourful language than that.
Was that regular? That was a usual thing for you as a kid, that you heard this music, you knew you had to
express it. I have music in my head all the time.
Still?
Yeah. Yeah, there's never a minute when I don't have music in the head. Whenever new members join the Waterboys, I say to them, do you have music in your head all the time? And some of them do.
And that's a good thing, is it?
Well, I think so, yeah. I think it's a great thing.
Yeah, but they have to tap into the music that you're hearing to an extent, don't they?
Well, I like people to play from their own colours and their own soul. And I prefer not to have to say a lot to a musician. When Steve and I play, I almost never say, well, could you play this line? Because he comes up with stuff that's better than I would think of.
And was that a different way of working when you went to Dublin, though? Because you were suddenly working with Steve and then an ever-expanding group of musicians who brought their own thing to the group. Because before, it was very much your vision, wasn't it? It was very much your sound in your head that you were trying to capture in the studio.
Yes, that was a big difference between those early big music records and the Fisherman's Blues sound. In the earlier records, I would have imagined the record in my head, and going into the studio was an exercise in turning it into a reality. But for the Fisherman's Blues album, all I would have would be the bones of a song, and then the other guys would fill it in.
And how would you write normally then? That writing process changed. You had the whole thing written.
Well, do you know, I would always have begun with a song on a guitar, but on the first three albums, I would then think out all the other parts and imagine the finished record.
And with Fisherman's Blues, with the title track itself, was that the starting point for the record? Was that the first song that was fully formed?
It was recorded on the first day, but it wasn't the first song we recorded, no.
Which one was that?
The first song we recorded was a country and western number written by me called Stranger to Me.
Great song. That's a great song.
Didn't make the final cut of the album, the initial release of the album.
No, it didn't. It's on the box set that's coming out this autumn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Along with about, what, 80 other tracks?
84 other unreleased tracks, yeah.
Well, we're going to get into this, in fact, because we're going to hear how the album unfolded and why you ended up recording so many tracks. But, Steve, when it first kicked together, and you're at Whinmore Lane Studios in Dublin, first of all, weren't you?
Yeah, beautiful studio. I'm not sure if it's still there. I think it is still there, is it?
No, it's gone.
And what do you remember about first putting Fisherman's Blues, the track itself?
Well, we'd had a rehearsal the day before with two musicians that I knew, a fellow called Trevor Hutchinson and Peter McKinney. And we'd had good rehearsal, and we just thought that we were trying out this bass player and drummer. And Mike said to me and Anto, the saxophone player, to come along to the studio. We went down to Windmill Lane, and I remember walking in, and everything was set up for...
Your own fiddle was set up.
Yeah, fiddle was set up. Mike had surreptitiously sent somebody around to my flat to pick up all my gear, around to Anto's place, got all the gear and had it all ready. We walked in, and we were in the middle of a recording session without even thinking about it. I think that was part of the magic, because we didn't even know we were going to record or anything like that. It was just, we showed up and it just picked up the instruments as we were going to play.
And that song kicks off the theme musically and, I suppose, lyrically. The imagery throughout the song is of freedom, isn't it? Of the fishermen tumbling on the seas and the hurtling, fevered train. And was it consciously about trying to get away from somewhere and heading somewhere new?
I had been in a dysfunctional romantic relationship, John, that was quite painful. And I wrote the song during my escape from that relationship.
So it was directly about that relationship rather than about your relationship with the music business?
Oh, God, no. I wouldn't write a song about my relationship with the music business.
Yeah. It's the time.
And we're talking about this as if it's a major cultural shift within your musical outlook, but you are from Scotland, of course. You're tapping into Celtic roots. Why was it something that you hadn't really understood musically before?
Well, you know, like a lot of people, I disrespected the culture that I grew up in. I thought Scottish music was a sort of hinterland of kilted buffoonery. You know, funny sort of Gaelic music played by people with their knees sticking out of kilts. And then I moved to Ireland, and hanging out with Steve and going to pubs and hearing traditional players in sessions, I heard this music anew. And over a course of about 18 months, I developed a real healthy respect for Celtic music and discovered in the process that it was the same music as my own homeland. Mm. But it was a gradual discovery.
The record itself is almost in two parts. The first part was largely recorded at Whinmore Lane, wasn't it? You've still got the elements of the rock band in there, particularly in the track We Will Not Be Lovers, which could have been off one of the earlier records. It's quite an angry song, that one, isn't it?
Sure.
And what was it about?
It's about one real relationship that didn't work out and one attempted relationship where someone was trying to pull me and I wasn't going there.
Right, because I remember at the Glastonbury Festival, 86, I think you introduced it as a song about dictators, about politicians who weren't to be trusted.
Yeah, well, that's just a bit of stage chicanery.
Right. What led you to Spittle House in Galway, then? You're camped out in Whinmore Lane in Dublin. You've got the conventional setup there. Why the rambling collective approach?
Well, we had been working in Whinmore Lane on and off for about a year and a half, John. And we'd amassed this huge stack of tracks. And to be quite honest, we'd recorded so much music that as producer of the album, I just lost track of it. I couldn't make decisions. I loved everything that we'd done. And, you know, we had 80, 90, 100 tracks sitting there in Whinmore Lane. So eventually I realised the best thing to do is just come out of the studio, take 6 months off. And after those 6 months, I was ready to record again, but I didn't want to go back into the same environment. So I'd been hanging out in the west of Ireland, staying in a cottage in Spittle, which is this fishing village near Galway. And I figured, it's so great out here and I love it so much. And it's such an inspirational cultural area. Why not finish the album out here? So we looked around and found this stately pile called Spittle House with a big dining room with a nice natural reverb in it. And we rented it off the owner and put a studio in there.
With a lot of band members coming and going, so it was a pretty loose setup then.
It was, yeah. They were very disciplined sessions. You know, the Whinmore Lane sessions had been marked by an improvisational policy where we would just turn up at the studio and play maybe 12, 15 songs a day. And of those, maybe three or four would become contenders. But in Spittle House, we would do one song a day, and then we would play it again the next day, and we'd keep working on it till it was finished. I couldn't go back into the freewheeling Windmill Lane style.
Describe a typical day then, because you were all living together in the house or in cottages on the...
No, that would have been just too crazy. No, we stayed in holiday homes around the area.
Right.
And we would cycle into Spittle House along the seafront.
We'd get a call. Mike was producing. He'd be in there every day. And whoever, what musicians would be on, would get a call to come down and we'd cycle down. Beautiful coastline of Galway Bay. Springtime, and we'd arrive, do whatever was on for the day.
And the tape was going the whole time in that room then, was it?
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things that characterised Fisherman Blues, is there was always a tape running. And when we were working in Windmill Lane, we had two 24-track machines because we couldn't afford to miss something. And 24-track tapes only last for 15 minutes. Well, we slowed them down to half speed so they would last for 30 minutes. We would have a second catch-up machine so that when the tape was at 29 minutes, the engineer would put on another tape on the other machine and start that and catch whatever happened when the tape finished.
Right.
You see, so we'd never miss anything.
Was it just you suggesting musical direction, or was it a free-for-all with the musicians who were in the room? I mean, something like, When Will We Be Married? I mean, how would that tune have come up?
When Will We Be Married?
Yeah.
Wow. I bought a book in a shop in California called Folk Song Jamboree. It was a colourful book in the window of a junk shop. I thought, I'm having that. And there was this song, When Will We Be Married? And it had music notation and had a lyric. I couldn't read the musical notation, but I liked the lyric. And it had these lines about, you have your eye on Jimmy. And I thought, yeah, I'm going to steal that and make a new song out of it. Half the lyric is mine and about half is from this, in fact, it was a South African folk song. And then Steve played a jig. And the jig and the tune that I was singing went together.
A minor?
A minor, agree.
When will we be married, Molly? When will we be wed? When will we be bedded in the sun? Your eye on Jimmy, long Jimmy Lee. You have your eye on Jimmy and a fine man he. You have your eye on Jimmy, but you better let him be. Cause when you go Molly, oh, you'll be gone with me. When will we be married, Molly? When will we be wed? When will we be bedded in the same bed? When will we be married, Molly? When will we be wed? Take us on the jig, man.
Be married. And Mike, when you were recording that, and when that sort of tune was coming together, did it by that time, it felt totally natural to be inhabiting that kind of ancient tradition and borrowing lyrics from...
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Right.
We were hanging out with folk musicians all the time, playing in pub sessions, playing Celtic music. When I first went to the west of Ireland, I thought, I'm not going to dabble in this. I don't want to be a dabbler with one sort of folky-tinged song on the album. You know, I want to walk into this life and live it and become it and then bring back what we find.
Yeah.
It was serious. We weren't messing around.
And the penultimate track on the album is The Stolen Child, and it's a W.B. Yeats poem which you've set to music. And in a way, actually, this prefigures your most recent album
yep.
by 25 years,
yep.
because you've taken a lot of Yeats' poems and set them to music. And you do something slightly different here, because there's a poem, you sing the refrain, but you've borrowed a voice of a local man, and it's Thomas McKeown.
Yep.
He is a folk singer, a storyteller.
Well, he's a storyteller and a singer. He's a Gaelic singer from Connemara, which is this wild, mountainous, coastal region northwest of Galway. And we were working on this arrangement of The Stolen Child, and I didn't like the way my voice sounded reciting the verses. And I bought Tomasi's cassette tape in the local grocer shop, and his tape was brilliant. He had this amazing Matterhorn of a voice. So a couple of the guys in the band, they still argue about who, but they went up the coast to find this guy.
Mike was busy recording in the studio that
night. I was fixing fiddle mistakes.
They were busy, so. We asked where was Thomas McKeown. Oh, he lives up the road. He's a bit fond of the Jair, they said. So you better bring him something.
So you did?
So we did. And we knocked on the window in the middle of the night. He was frightened of his life. That was it. He told us to feck off, actually. That's what he told us. And we went back another time. There was two courtings, if you like, of Thomas McKeown.
It was the famous name of W.B. Yeats that made the difference.
Right.
When he heard he was to be reciting W.B. Yeats, he decided he would come.
And he delivers it with a great sonorous voice.
Yeah.
Very serious. Yeah. When he arrived in the studio, and there's, I guess, loads of people standing around and tapes rolling, did he get it straight away? How did you encourage
him? Well, we tried to set the scene for him, John. We were recording in the dining room and it had a fireplace, so we put a turf fire on and we put a pint of Guinness on a table for him. I didn't know till later he wasn't a Guinness drinker, but he was too polite to say. So he's there with a microphone and headphones. He'd never worn headphones in his life, and a pint and a turf fire. So it was a decent attempt at an atmosphere.
This is the guy, isn't it?
I've just taken
the inner sleeve from the original vinyl record. In fact, he has pride of place, really, on the inner sleeve, doesn't he? It's the biggest photograph.
Ah, well, he's done
a lead
vocal.
He's a very handsome-looking man, isn't he, with his black shirt on there. Was it easy to coax that performance out of him? Was it a one-take in the Waterboy style?
No, it wasn't. It was very difficult, John. The problem was that Tomas was used to singing or reciting unaccompanied, and he couldn't find the beat in the music. And The Stolen Child is set to a rolling piano rhythm, which is quite hard to hear the beat in. Yeah. I'll show you what I mean. Now, I can hear where the one is in that, but if you didn't have a drum going boom,
yeah,
boom, boom, it would be hard to hear. Tomas couldn't find the beat. So when he was reciting, it was all in the wrong places. He went back to his cottage to practice, but when he came back, there was no real difference. He just couldn't hear the rhythm. So he said to me, Mike, would you give me a cue for every line? I didn't really want to, because I respected him as a representative of this venerable tradition, and the thought of me, a whippersnapper, cueing him like a conductor. But I did it. It was the only way to get the record. So we sat there, opposite sides of the turf fire, with the undrunk pint of Guinness, and I cued him for every phrase, just before where I imagined the phrase would fall, and that's how we got it.
But what a result, though.
Yeah, fantastic.
And I think possibly the most beautiful and most delicate song on the album is When You Go Away, which features an array of instruments. It's got the bouzouki on there, and it's got what I always thought was a slide guitar, but in fact it's slide mandolin.
It is, yeah.
And an amazingly delicate musical setting for a very heartbreaking and lovelorn lyric. Another personal one, or was that an imagined heartbreak?
It was written about someone else's real heartbreak.
And do you remember writing it? How did that come about? Because that seems like a more conventionally constructed, composed song.
Do you know, it began life as a song called Killing My Heart, John, which we'd recorded in Winmalane a year earlier with the same lyric and a different tune. And when we were in Spittle House, we invited a trad band called De Dannan to come and play with us. We wanted to record a slow traditional tune called Carolyn's Welcome. And they came and we recorded the track, and it all went much quicker than we'd expected. And we suddenly, the rest of the day, but with nothing to do. So everybody said, come on, let's record another song. And I didn't have a song. The bouzouki player from De Dannan, he said, come on, Mike, you can come up with a song. So I went upstairs in Spittle House with my guitar and I started playing. And I thought, okay, well, we never quite got Killing My Heart right, so maybe I'll take that lyric and I'll put it to another tune. So that's what I did. And then I came downstairs and we recorded it just as you hear it on the record.
Well, I'd like you to play us out of this part of the programme with a live version of When You Go Away. But for now, my thanks to Mike Scott and Steve Wickham of the Waterboys. In the second part of this edition, the B-side, we'll be hearing more about the making of Fisherman's Blues and its legacy, and we'll have questions from our studio audience. You can hear that tomorrow afternoon at 3:30 here on Radio 4. This and previous editions are available to listen to and download via the Master Tapes pages at the Radio 4 website, where you can also see videos of some of our exclusive performances from this and the previous series, and you can always tweet about the programme using the hashtag MasterTapes. In the meantime, though, Mike Scott and Steve Wickham, take it away.
Now he's brought down the rain, the Indian summer is through. In the morning you'll be following your trail again, fair play to you. You ain't calling me to join you, and I'm spoken for anyway. But I will cry when you go away. I will cry when you go away. Your beauty is familiar, and your voice is like a key. It plays upon my mind, and it opens up a door inside of me. Your coat is made of magic, and around your table angels play. I will cry when you go away. I will cry when you go away.
And if you want to hear more material recorded at this Master Tape session, including exclusive performances, photographs and videos, go to the Master Tapes pages via the Radio 4 website.